Hello and welcome to another episode of the 1020 podcast. Today I'll be talking to Daniel Behrmann. Daniel Behrmann received his BA in political science and history from Bates College, an MLit in Iranian studies from the University of St. Andrews, and his PhD in international history from the London School of Economics and Political Science. His work has been published in The Diplomat, The Times of Israel, and The American Conservative, and has also been featured on Real Clear Politics. He worked in the United States Senate and advised the last administration. Daniel has been a profound commentator on ongoing political events, both historically and from a geopolitical perspective, and I'm very much looking forward to talking about him about the latest geopolitical developments. Right into it. So Daniel, thank you so much for being with us today. And I very much have enjoyed over the last couple of months your analysis, and particularly something you wrote recently, which I think is something that many commentators suffer from, kind of the dilemma of commenting on Twitter and writing long-form analysis, because the long-form analysis always has the problem of being late and not kind of be an immediate comment on it. So I think this is always something that people are torn between.
So I think that's half of it. But I think another thing is there's a psychological aspect, which is if you're working a long form piece, it's harder to get started on it because your feeling is that without a clear prompt, you need a clear beginning, middle, and end. You can't simply make good points. There has to be some sort of reason why an article exists. And I think that one of the great things about Substack and other sources is they kind of give people the options of institutionalizing it, albeit with a feeling that you have to do a certain amount of work on a certain number of dates, which is sort of a different side of that.
I mean, you don't shy away even on your Twitter account. You tend to use as much of historical analysis as you can. So I think even there, the information value is still very, very high, which kind of brings me to the probably point that is on everybody's mind. Now, almost 110 days after the beginning of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, kind of what's your take of the current situation, right? If somebody would ask you, kind of if you look at the warring parties, if you look at the situation, what do you think are we in for in the next couple of weeks and months? Is it going to be a protracted war? Is it kind of going, until the end of the year, maybe even multiple years? Or do you think that we might be even closer to a one-sided ceasefire, right? That Russia might say, okay, they at least make a temporary ceasefire and then pick up operations again next year. What's your sense of the coming developments?
So I think we've settled into a slow development of operations, which is different than a pure stalemate. I think the pro-Russian sources that keep and have been predicting a Ukrainian collapse for a long time are off the mark. But I think that the way in which the attrition has developed that we've seen over the last few weeks is two things. One of them is that while the Ukrainians are able to launch limited sort of counterattacks in the open against unfortified Russian mobile units, they're not able to basically take fortified positions that the Russians have built up that are basically prepared defenses. So we've seen an offensive in Kharkiv that basically advanced into territory that was not vital for the Russians. It definitely was real and drove them back, but then it reached a limit at which they either had to go further and risk taking fortified positions or advancing into areas that would have risked their forces trying to cut the supply lines, or they had the same problem the Germans in 1918 had after their offensives, which is they'd gone out of their own fortified positions. They were now in less defensible territory of less value. They either had to keep going at risk or they had to pull back, which is what they did. And the thing that struck me is the same thing I've seen in Kherson, is there's tactical advances, but the Ukrainians don't seem to know how to use them strategically and end up sort of pulling back after them. The Russians, on the other hand, I think have gotten a dynamic in the Donbass whereby they're able to attack in a large number of places. A bunch of them fail, but ultimately they are better able to rotate movement units and control the tempo of escalation and de-escalation. And that means that eventually the Ukrainians are, because there's a breakthrough somewhere else, even if they hold in 7 out of 8 places, they eventually end up having to pull back. Now, I think this is a limited thing. And I think that it's going to end up costing them much the rest of Luhansk, not least because I think Lysychansk, and I apologize for pronunciation, I don't think has a secure rail line left. So I think you're going to see that being pulled out from. It's a good defensive position. It has artillery control, can't be taken. But it also, if it can't be supplied, the value of having an artillery position without artillery ammunition is kind of limited. I think what's going to basically happen is the Russians are going to continue this, not so much for territorial objectives, because I don't think it's really a territorial war. I think it's a political war, until they get the impression that they've accomplished what they want to do politically, which is change the narrative into a Russian military advantage. At that point, I think they can basically decrease the tempo of operations, fairly safe in the knowledge that the Ukrainians can't launch counteroffensive now, and that that reduces the political will in the West to give the Ukrainians the ability to do so. At which point, I think that they wait, and then they assume that the unwillingness of Western states to provide that aid will demoralize the Ukrainians and make them more willing to sort of negotiate. I think what Russia's always wanted here is a Ukraine, not that necessarily was not joining NATO, because I don't think the prospect of them joining was there, but I think they want a Ukraine where they don't believe NATO provides an alternative to appeasing Russia, in the sense of any Ukrainian government would think that you have to keep Russia happy because it's on your borders. And the reason why a Ukrainian government feels free to follow an anti-Russian policy line is because they believe NATO will protect them. So I think if you manage to prove that's not the case, that kind of accomplishes the strategic goal. And I think that's sort of where the Russians are trying to be on course for. Now, is that a victory? I suspect they wanted it significantly earlier. I think they've lost a lot of prestige and image, and especially soft power. And in the West, that doesn't really matter because that had lost any value anyway. Elsewhere, it matters a bit more. But that's kind of a sunk cost. I think that is a salvageable situation for Putin insofar as there's not a clear alternative for anyone else in the Russian elite.
I mean, that's one thing I've been wrestling with, and you have touched upon this on your Substack, which I would also recommend to all our listeners and viewers, which was about the kind of the goals of the Russians and the goals of Putin. So I was wondering to hear a take on. So the Russians started mobilizing at the Ukrainian border in the fall of 2021. And the invasion started in February 24th. So I was wondering, do you think, for example, if on the very first day of the invasion, let's say the European Union or the West in general would really have made unprecedented sanctions, also in the energy sector, right? That they would have strategically surprised Moscow, that they would have not just made the kind of sanctions that I assume, I mean, I'm spitballing here, but that I assume that Russia was expecting. They were expecting some sanctions, but others not. And if they would have gotten in much harder than Putin would have expected, do you think there would have been a chance that they kind of would have pulled back, or maybe only have done the independence and the integration of these eastern provinces? Because what I'm trying to get at this is that if we can talk about this in a few minutes, I hope, if we ignore for a second the performance of the Russian army, and if we ignore for a second the performance of the Ukrainian army, can on all other fronts, it looks like that the Russian expectations kind of seem to have to play out, right? The military side kind of didn't seem to play out, but all other elements seem to have gone, not in their favor, but have gone as good as they could have hoped for.
So I'm not actually certain. I mean, I think the problem with the sanctions debate is a general problem with this discussion, which is it's all about assuming, it's asking ourselves what we would have done. And I think a better question is, okay, let's say you did that. Putin's already committed. And a decision as to whether to sort of try and integrate the Donbass and stop versus hit Kiev is already been made at the point at which Russian troops are in Kiev and Russian media is talking about troops in Mariupol. It's the Russians have broken out of the Crimea. They're in Kiev. So I think one, the fact that you're already propaganda-wise in Kiev means the idea of retreating in front of sanctions cannot be sold as anything other than defeat. So it's a bit too late. Secondly, the very successes in the Crimea are actually a bit of a problem for disengagement. Because if you fail to make advances anywhere, like say this was a limited attack in the Donbass and everyone charged into trenches, then you might have a China-Vietnam 79 situation where the fact that the Chinese failed utterly to take any territory meant they could simply end the operation without having to question what they were going to do with territory they had taken. The fact that the Russians actually managed to overrun a large part of Ukraine in the first 24 hours creates a problem for any subsequent ceasefire withdrawal, especially if that's not territory the Russians necessarily wanted or the Ukrainians can give up. And I think that in some ways, we focus so much on the Russian failures, but the one area where they're actually military successful, I think, is as much an obstacle for a quick end of the war as anything else, because Ukraine can't let them hold actual Ukrainian-speaking areas there. Like, let's leave aside the fact that the Russian-speaking thing is overdone. Politically, the Russians are sitting in areas near Kherson and other things that that politically Ukraine can't give up. They don't necessarily have a claim to, but they're holding them. What do you do? You need to get an exchange. And it also isn't just Ukrainian recognition, it's recognition of Crimea. So I think at that point, you're kind of, it's unclear what sanctions could possibly have done it, because Putin withdrawing at that point is not just doing the sanctions. He's sending a message that the West can do whatever it wants with sanctions. So the question is, if hardline Western sanctions on energy get Putin to abandon a major invasion he's in and humiliating, can't those same sanctions get him to leave the Donbass? Could those same sanctions get him to leave the Crimea? And isn't that an incentive to leave those sanctions in effect and add additional demands? And I think that is a perverse incentive on it that was created. And I think that's a strong reason why, unless they were actually going to cripple Russia's ability to fight, they weren't going to cause them to stop. Now, that said, before they went in, if you had made a firm line that you were going to do stuff rather than going back and forth on SWIFT, rather than going back and forth on energy, and you managed to not just say you were going to do it, but you managed to convince Putin and everyone in the Kremlin that those sanctions were going to follow, I think that might have deterred it before it happened. But I think sanctions after it happened were never about influencing Russian behavior. They were only about degrading Russian capabilities.
In this brings, you mentioned something, and this is, of course, again, we can only speculate about this, but I would be very curious about your opinion on this, because you wrote something similar on your Substack. You made this very interesting case. You kind of compared the invasion of Ukraine with the German invasion of Poland in 1939, and you describe a hypothetical scenario. What if Hitler would have ordered kind of an immediate attack from East Prussia on Warsaw, where you say, well, you could have done that, right? You could have had then the headline, Germans in Warsaw, but they would probably not have been able to take it with such an very quick advance. So do you think, is the performance of the Russian army, do you think we can at least look at this in a way, is it a failure of the Russian command, or do you think it might also have been a scenario where the political side demanded something of the military that they then kind of had to try because they were ordered to do so, but they kind of knew that this probably was not possible? So is it a failure of the military, or do you think there's also an element of a failure of the politicians and of Putin himself, of course?
The supply stuff, the logistics, all of that is a failure of the military. Though, to be fair, that is a... Did my signal go out?
Now you're back. You were gone for 1 second.
Okay. Do you want me to try a stronger connection? Just give me a second. Are we... Right. Is that better?
Let me see. Do you think maybe it's on my, it could be my end?
Is this better?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So in answer to that question, I think that the failures of the Russian military are, first of all, The logistics and other stuff are structural. They've been failures since the late Soviet period. You saw versions of them in Afghanistan. You obviously saw them in Chechnya. I think the failure to fix them is a reflection of the way in which Putin's state and structure has degraded significantly since 2012 and since his return to the presidency. And the appointments of Shoigu and Gerasimov over their predecessors were reflective of that. So you can't exclude a political thing with it. That said, I think the strategic decision shows every sign of having been political in the sense that I mean, there's an Occam's razor here. I mean, it is possible that generals and other people who had seen action in Syria had some awareness of Russian either had no awareness of Russian capabilities or thought that you could do the multi-axis advance and do the Kiev and other things. My impression is, however, that the major thrusts are where you would politically do them if you were trying to refight 2014. In the sense of they're what you should have done in 2014 if you were trying to do regime change. Kharkiv has major pro-Russian movement and in the Russian spring. Kiev would be in chaos. And the idea is that the last three times this has happened, 2004, 2014, but also in our periods, the Ukrainian government just dissolves. Like it falls apart, two-thirds of the parliament flee, everyone deserts. So the idea that if you could get any troops there, you get into chaos or other things, people will flee and collapse, that will work is something that's very easy to convince yourselves of. That's doubly true if you are not trusting your own information, you're secondly getting it from foreign media. Because one thing that we forget is that, and now I don't know if this was a misinformation campaign or people were legitimate on it, but in the lead up to the war, there was a ton of discussion about whether or not Zelensky should flee. The US pulled out its embassies. A bunch of European states were doing so. They were talking about relocating to Poland. If you're reading this just sort of in your free time and stuff, the impression you get is that the West, everyone else's plan is for Zelensky to flee the first moment anyone gets there, which means if you get there and he flees and other stuff, that's a geopolitical and that's a PR victory that's worth exposing it, especially because if there's no one in charge, then any sort of counterattack against your columns or other problems won't exist. Now, I'm not saying this is wise. If you were looking for reasons why this wouldn't work, you could find them. But politically, if you're a layperson, there's more than enough information there that you can credibly and logically convince yourself this is going to work without being in some sort of COVID bubble. Like, I can easily see US policy planners at the level of the people who did the Iraq war basically come to the same conclusions that are behind this. It isn't illogical. Everything involved in it is perfectly logical. It is clear why it didn't work, but it also is clear why someone would think it would work.
I mean, right, in hindsight, we always know better. Yeah. I remember I had a conversation with somebody from the International Institute for Strategic Studies in like mid-February, right? And they argued that the entire Ukrainian army is in a form of reconstruction. And if the war comes now, it's like at the worst possible moment. So that there were many even experts, right, who claimed in mid-February that if Russia should invade, that the Ukrainian army would fold. I think that so that the surprise probably was not just for the Russians. I think there were many in the West as well that at least did not anticipate that kind of resistance.
So I know the Jamestown sort of report they did in the summer 2021, they have that entire paragraph where they talk about the javelins. And they say that no Ukrainian units on the front line have ever seen javelins. They're not with them. They're stored centrally in Kiev. Like that's from July or August 2021. If that's going around in policy circles, and I know it was being circulated in January in US ones, then clearly the Russians probably read it. And if they're seeing that, the expectation is you're not going to see javelins in frontline units, much less territorial defense. Now, I think that makes a lot of sense of what the Russians would do, which is the way you do sort of blitzkrieg is actually not the idea of charging tanks against defended positions. You send them in flying columns to sort of bridges or small towns or crossroads, then they set up defensive positions there. They drive out the few people with just rifles, and then they basically, you have to assault them to get them out. And as the Ukrainians have found, and as everyone found, it's much harder to attack a defended position that has armor and other stuff, even with anti-tank weapons, than it is to defend a position against a unsupported armored attack with anti-tank weapons. So that makes perfect sense to break up into those columns and then send them flying everywhere. If your assumption is the 30 or 40 or so territorial defense or 100 of them who are going to be in these smaller areas are not going to have any javelins or anything else, and they'll be fighting with old rifles. If they have javelins, that's suicide, because the moment you enter any of those areas, you're dead. At which point you have these columns that are now stuck on the roads. But the question is, if they weren't given enough food and logistics to pull back, you don't have a good communication system to figure out what's going on. They simply go back and forth in the roads till they run out of fuel. And then you get a lot of the images of abandoned vehicles and everything else, which looks like a colossal disaster, and to be fair, was. But the way in which it emerges does not actually require the sort of almost farcical mockery that it received. It is based on bad intelligence, but if the premises behind it were correct, it would have worked.
I mean, there was a couple of weeks ago, there was a monk debate between Stephen Walt and John Mersheimer on the one side, and I forgot his first name. I think he was a former ambassador to Russia, McFall, and Radislav Sikorsky, and the kind of the discussion, of course, right, very early on, kind of was circulating on the question, what was the motivation for the war, right? That there is kind of the Mersheimer-Walt position, that the reason for the war is kind of, you know, security concerns on the side of the Russians, and then it was the McFall-Sikorsky position, that this is just kind of reviving the Russian imperialist dream. Where do you come down on this debate, right? Both sides kind of think there's a credible historic argument, I think there's a credible theoretical argument, but if you kind of would be faced with these two options, right? Is it a quote-unquote legitimate is a strong word, but kind of an understandable kind of security concern, or do you think there is, of course, this element of real kind of desire for reviving imperial grandeur as well? Or what would you come down on this debate?
So I think part of the problem I have with the Walt and Mearsheimer line is it's a bit of a distinction without a difference, in the sense that Russia's definition of its security interests, not just now, but for the last 300 or 400 years, is inherently destabilizing, in the sense that Russia's vision of its security interests are ones in which the other powers in Europe exist to balance each other, with Russia holding the decisive balancing role. It doesn't necessarily require Russia to dominate it. And I think there's a long Russian tradition that views efforts to dominate as much historical mistakes as efforts to appease and give up the balance of power. And I think actually when Putin condemns and says one of the biggest mistakes Stalin made was imposing Stalinist regimes in Eastern Europe, he is to some degree honest on it. That's actually a revision to what Alexander I tried to do, what Catherine tried and failed to do for many of the same reasons. And I actually think she's the best analogy to Putin in a lot of ways, as opposed to Peter the others. The problem with it is that this system of balance of power is a balance of power that works very well for Russia, but involves everyone else either being victims of Russia or petition or basically pensioners of Russia. In the 1800s, this involved basically Austria and Prussia competing for Russia's favor, while Britain paid Russia to basically paralyze them and paralyze them from helping France, and in which Poland and Sweden and other states, Britain helped subsidize Russian domination of them in exchange for Russia's domination of Central Europe, which then involved allowing them to let Russia do whatever it wanted elsewhere. And the problem with the system is it's bad for everyone except Russia. And the moment Russia gets weak, or everyone else manages to overcome their differences, they unite. The Poles and Swedes threw off in that period the Russian yoke, Sweden successfully with Gustavus III, Poland unsuccessfully in the 1790s. And partially in that climate, that was occurring in a climate where Britain backed Prussia and Austria to uniting, where Russia was along with Turkey and other people. And the immediate thing is that Russia's efforts to basically dominate everyone else by playing them off resulted at various points in everyone uniting against Russia. And Russia's solution is to claim that this is an existential threat. And the claim is that Poland having a constitution or anything else is an existential threat. Solution was destroy Poland and seize Finland. And the response is basically you forced us to do it. There was a coalition forming against us and it was uniting. This is self-defense, a legitimate defense of our interests, which is, you know, true in a manner of speaking, but I'm not sure anyone else would agree on it. And it's inherently unstable because it leaves the same situation that eventually is going to leave you into 1914 and the 1940s. So I think in a sense, Russia's in a situation whereby any Russian withdrawal is going to lead to all of its border states looking at this. Because the thing is, Ukraine, in order to have an independent policy of Russia, needs enough military strength. It needs foreign allies to protect it from Russia. And that means it's going to seek foreign alliances. Even if you want an equal and friendly relationship with Russia, in order to be able to have leverage, you need other options. And the very existence of those other options means forming alliances with Russia's enemies. Now, this is what happened with Poland in joining NATO, and it's consistently what happens. Poland joining NATO moved that issue to Ukraine. And this is also why I don't agree with Mearsheimer and Walt, because if you simply moved the NATO line, then all what's happening with Ukraine would be happening with Poland. Poland would, in order to prevent a situation in which Putin can threaten governments by saying, if you're allowing people to do these memorials to KTN or you're doing this other stuff, it's anti-Russian rhetoric, you're tolerating anti-Russian extremism, you're tolerating neo-Nazism, and God knows there's enough weird parades and other stuff in Poland to justify him doing that, then you'd be having this exact same debate there. This is always happens with wherever Russia's borders are. So the question a little bit here is, where do you want this dynamic to be occurring? Do you want it to occur in the Ukraine? Do you want it to occur in West Germany, in Hungary, as it sort of was in the Cold War? Or do you want it to be occurring in the Ukraine? There is no choice that it won't occur because there is a structural sort of dynamic there. And that's also why I don't think Mearsheimer and Walt have a problem they've correctly identified. And I think people who are dismissive of the problem or say it's only a Putin problem or it's a purist problem are missing the point. The problem is they don't have a solution to the problem.
So kind of if I try to summarize also a little bit what you just said, right? So even if kind of we would have followed some of the recommendations that particularly Mearsheimer made, right? Kind of if we said immediately there will be no NATO membership of Ukraine and kind of there will be no approachment towards the EU, we might have ended up in a similar situation nonetheless, because as you pointed out, in one way, shape, or form, like Ukraine would have needed not an alliance, but kind of support from other countries in order to counterweigh the potential the threats from Russia, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, Putin threatened, like he mobilized troops against Kuchma. Yeah. He actually mobilized troops and did exercises to threaten Yanukovych over the EU association agreement. There is no one who's pro-Russian enough as president of Ukraine, short of a Lukashenko type. And the thing is, even Putin feuded with Lukashenko consistently, and that wasn't a stable relationship. There is no stable basis for this because this is a chronic insecurity problem. I mean, there is a potential solution that has worked at various points in history, but it's the exception rather than the rule. And that's a situation where Russia feels secure in and of itself in its own position. And I mean, that's one, if Russia were rich and prosperous and felt integrated enough, then these things would matter less. And now we're going into sort of alternative history. I actually do think that there was a long shot, and I don't think there's any prospect of people putting in the money and effort needed to do it. But if you had done, how much money have we spent in Iraq and Afghanistan? It's trillions. If you'd be willing to put in $100 billion, $150 billion into Russia, which is basically to stabilize it, and by stabilize, I don't mean like fund the privatization. I mean pour enough money that even the flaws that were inevitably going to happen with the implementation of privatization, even the adjustments, you could basically subsidize your way through to ensure that people's living standards wouldn't be up. And you got over that hump into the boom that was starting even before Putin came in. And then you also basically use the EU expansion in things like Schengen and other stuff. And I think models like Schengen or the free trade zone, and you tried to build that in. And then one of the things I think you should have done is done the oil integration earlier in energy. Rather than doing it, you build a common European economy and you build a common sort of integrated thing. I think you create a situation whereby Russians feel integrated into a single economic unit and a single sort of cultural unit with it. But that would have required you to do things 10 years earlier and spend vastly more money than anyone was willing to do so without realizing sort of the stakes. So, I mean, it's counterfactual, but I'm unsure how much realistic it is. I think if people go back in time now, they might be able to do it, but I don't think there's any chance of it prevailing as a policy then. But I think unless sort of Russians feel that, one, there is a level of membership in a wider European family that, one, is available, and two, actually is on a level that isn't the same as sort of Italy, but is at least on par with Germany or France, I think that is the thing in which they'd accept. And the other thing is here, is Ukraine subordinate to France and Germany if it's going to join the EU? Romania is subordinate to France and Germany because, I mean, nominally the EU is equal, but it's not really. A Russia that was on par with Germany and France at the table in the EU or Britain still is more powerful and is in a room making decisions like over the Greek bailout when the border states aren't. And in that sense, that partnership potentially could have. Now, I think Scholz and some, I don't think Scholz is sophisticated enough to get this. I think there are some Germans who loosely imagine that enough to know that if that were possible, that might be an idea. But what they miss is that isn't possible with this Russia, with this Russian economy, with this generation who've lived through the last 30 years, and with Putin who's lived through the last 30 years. The trust isn't there on either side. Developments have moved in the wrong way economically. They've moved in the wrong way culturally. They've moved the wrong way politically. But I am willing to say that I understand the vision they have is something that in a different world could work and actually would be the ideal.
I mean, it is a little bit counterfactual history, but I think you make a very, very important point here. Isn't it true to say that even after the Soviet Union dissolved and the Cold War ended, right? The West never stopped to treat Russia as the Soviet Union. And what I mean by this is, and I was listening very carefully after the conflict started in February, there were plenty of commentators, of TV anchors, who by accident, but I think it shows you what's going on subconsciously, if you will. And I don't want to have my Freudian side here out too much. But when they say the Soviet Union, right? The Soviets, right? Even in 2022, right? People use the term Soviet and Russia as kind of being the same. So shouldn't we, and this, I'm not trying to shift blame here, don't get me wrong, but you cannot treat a country as if it is the Soviet Union and then be surprised if at some point it behaves like it. It's similar. Imagine we would still talk about Germany as the Third Reich, right? So that would never happen, right? Or Japan as Imperial Japan. Like, there was a shift in how these countries were treated after 1945, but it seems there was never a shift in how Russia was even culturally perceived after 1992, right? The Ruski was always kind of the Soviet. So there was never a kind of, they were never allowed to go further back in their own history, right? As this kind of more, never fully, I guess, but more European nation that they have been before 1917. So if you treat them as the other, wasn't it almost a natural consequence that they would become the other at some point?
So this is sort of a weird story. When I was really little, I had a friend who had like a Super Nintendo entertainment system. They had this game called Aerobiz Supersonic, which is a game where you have a bunch of airlines and strategy one. And one of the scenarios is the future. And one of the events they have is the Soviet Union joining the European Community in 2021. It's just one of the dates they have, which is an interesting one. But I think it shows like where some people thought things could have gone in 1991. And I think that's actually a bit different in the sense that I think there was a vision that if Gorbachev's reforms had succeeded in building a liberal democratic state, there that was prosperous and rich, you could have basically extended the European project in the EC, not just Eastern Europe, but all the way to the Pacific, which is, in a lot of ways, I actually think that was the vision that Alexander II had when he sold Alaska to the United States, which is he also tried to sell Kamchatka and back the Union in the Civil War, but he very much saw this idea that there would be a single economic block stretching across sort of North America all the way across Siberia that would be integrated as a alternative to the British, a sort of one in which Americans would develop it. And I mean, Alexander II was weird in a lot of ways. I mean, I think in some ways he's the most idealistic Russian ruler, maybe the most naive as well as Gorbachev. But like, I think that the problem we had actually is that is actually the opposite, is we started viewing Russia as a failed state to be quarantined and put on life support rather than helped. So the entire approach to Yeltsin in 96 was basically that the communists have not done the minimum that communist parties, say, in Poland or Hungary or other places had done to sort of provide an alternative government. I mean, if they had and they'd reinvented themselves and reassured people, the key Russian elites would have been open to them winning. And I don't think we were attached to it. It was just the fear that Russia would totally collapse into chaos if Zyuganov won that led to that intervention. And I think this is a big thing when Putin comes in, because when people say, was Putin pro-Western? Was he scorned? Was he offended? I think Putin was willing to do a partnership, if you look at sort of his initial relations with Bush and stuff. But he wanted a partnership, which is, if he wasn't equal to the US, he wanted to be number two, at least on par with, say, the UK, Australia, others. But when you look at, and I mean, he let the US use military bases for Afghanistan and other stuff. But when it came to Iraq, I don't even think it was the decision to go into Iraq or other things. It's that when Bush decided to make the decision, the discussions internally were with Tony Blair. They were with Azdar in Spain. They were with John Howard. Everyone else was told after the fact. So Putin was told and told, this is what we're going to do. We expect you to vote for us at the UN. He wasn't even asked his opinion or asked his views or involved in the consultations. He was treated like Italy. He wasn't treated like Britain. I mean, I'm leaving off Germany there because France, because there were bad relations on it. But like, that is insulting, because it's saying that even if you're going to be supportive, you're not even going to be treated on the level of the UK. You're not going to be part of the decision-making apparatus of this. Now, even if you're not expecting the US to run an equal decision-making, and no one expects the US to treat Britain as an equal except for the British, and a few people in weird London think tanks and stuff, and a few Aussies, the Russians are like, I think that he expected to be treated on par with it. I mean, he's going off to Crawford, he's doing this. And I think the conclusion he drew is that the US was never going to take Russia unless it respected Russia. And it was never going to respect Russia if Russia gave and did not take. And here's the problem with this. Is he wrong? And my experience in Washington and other stuff is, like, this is going to get me in trouble for saying this, I'm not actually sure he is. Like, what was, if he didn't do this and he's negotiating, is there any chance the US was ever going to put pressure on the Ukrainians to do Minsk? Is there ever a chance that even if he abandoned Minsk, there was going to be recognition of the Crimea, even though he can't give it up and no other Russian leader plausibly can, in which case sanctions are going to last indefinitely on it? Probably not. If he withdrew from the Donbass unilaterally, just like Gorbachev did, would that be seen as a concession to be rewarded and do in a partnership? Would it be seen as a sign that the sanctions worked and a reason why to impose even harsher ones until he leaves the Crimea or does other things? And you have to remember, before the Ukraine thing, when Crimea occurred, when the Orange Revolution occurred and before Crimea, Putin was in Sochi for the Olympics. And who was not in Sochi? Not any American representative, not Obama, not a member of the cabinet, and not the US ambassador. Why? Because we were all boycotting because of the LGBT propaganda law that Russia had passed. So in effect, Russia was already under sanctions, one, because we didn't like how Putin basically ran for election and came back, and two, we didn't like a domestic law he passed. And we were willing to sanction him for that. If we were willing to sanction him for that, is there a path back, or do you have to go forward before you can go back? And like, I think this worked in two parts. I think once Boone decided he had to go forward, he began creating additional justifications and grievances, not artificially in his head, in the sense that I think he's actually convinced of a lot of stuff in his essay last summer. But I think the conclusion he came to, which is, if you look back at history, look at Gorbachev, but also you look at his own experiences, Russia is not important enough to anyone other than as a gas station that they're ever going to care enough to risk the domestic backlash of actually talking and treating you as an equal.
But isn't this a little bit, I mean, that the I think you mentioned this a little bit, right? The kind of also the internal dynamics and the internal weaknesses of Russia. But isn't this also, and you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, but isn't this also a huge risk? I mean, if they're seen now as at least militarily not as strong as they were perceived before this, I mean, if you look at that, and I'm just curious what you think about the rhetoric about this. I mean, I find this, like, so at the beginning it was, kind of about repelling the invasion. But now there are, and maybe these are just loud voices and not serious voices. That's also possible. But now there's even talk about, you know, that the Russian Federation needs to be dismantled, and I'm not even calling it a division. But do you think there is a risk that at some point this could be perceived, whether justifiably or not, as an existential threat by Russia, right? In the sense of when all of a sudden the war goes from, not so much from Ukraine, but from the West, kind of shift, not just from defending and maintaining a viable, independent Ukraine, but if there's really this idea, you need to bring Russia to, whatever that means, right? Nobody ever says what it means, but kind of to bring them to their knees. And, you know, that all these other supposed people that are under the Russian boot need to be liberated. I mean, if you talk about the dissolution or something, and I'm using the most extreme case just kind of to emphasize the point, do you think there is a risk that this is going to be perceived as an existential threat and, of course, leads them to up to potentially, I don't want to talk about this that much, but up to the nuclear option in war?
So, I mean, it is an existential threat. I mean, people are befuddled as to why Putin's sort of approval ratings went up or public opinion. But, I mean, even if you're someone who didn't like this war, doesn't like the trajectory of stuff that's going on for the last 7 or 8 years, if you're a Russian citizen, your future depends on the economic well-being of Russia. It depends on how people treat Russia. What are the consequences of a massive Russian defeat, especially if it leads to, like, loss of territory from February 26th? I mean, one, it's the end of Russia's sort of great power, which means that you have a lot of predatory stuff coming in from other places. But two, I mean, all the reasons people give for why people should turn against Putin are not clearly going to be improved by a defeat. For instance, sanctions. If sanctions are sufficient or viewed as sufficient to degrade Russia's capabilities and get them to lose in the Ukraine, aren't they going to be capped until you leave the Donbass? And then aren't they going to be capped until you leave the Crimea? And once you've done that, isn't that going to send a message to the Ukrainians, you know, or Ukrainian nationalists, you know, this actually works as a strong stand and encourages them to do it? And this goes back to the LGBT sort of propaganda law thing. The U.S. was already trying and experimenting with sanctions and cultural boycotts and what Putin would term cancellation, which is, it was actually closer to that in terms of going after individual people or doing on a personal level. On Russian internal politics. Does this mean that until the US and other countries will use this, not stop at Russia's borders, try and use this until Russia does what they want, will they start using this to try and get favorable fuel contracts? Will they do other things? And I think the idea of people breaking up Russia, given the current thing, is a bit irrational and delusional. But there are fears that you can't allow what the Western response here to work without serious negative consequences for your position, for the position of your kids, for everyone else. And this isn't just an issue for a couple thousand people in the Russian elite. It's a large portion of the Russian population that have this. And I mean, you can talk about whether or not we should do this when Putin's gone or other things, but I think even that's an artificial discussion because, I mean, part of the discussion on Crimea or other things is twofold. It's one, should you be dealing with Putin to end this war on it? But two, in the long run, how important is Crimea v. stabilizing, which is, it may very well not be worth recognizing Crimea as Russian to get a ceasefire in Ukraine. It may very well be, if, for instance, Putin were to fall or something else at a future point, and you've had a peace here, recognizing it as part of a wider effort to stabilize the relationship between Ukraine and Russia, if doing so would legitimize a more liberal government in Russia and give them the credibility to drop all of their other demands and accept everything else, like Ukrainian integration, and would stabilize them at home, because that might be in everyone's interest compared to other things. And I think this is my problem with these absolutist statements on it. It is different to say we shouldn't trade Crimea for X, to say that you should never, ever consider it, and we should continue this current conflict until who knows what. I mean, the goal here has to be a stable order in Eastern Europe that allows for the cooperation of a Russian state with Europe and the West, and for the development of the Russian people. And an ideal world is one in which there are no sanctions. There is no indefinite sanction with Russia. There is no constant need for constant military stuff, which means that you need a situation everyone can live with. Otherwise, you have World War I going into World War II, which is you have a ceasefire. You have the Seven Years' War and the War of Austrian Succession, the War of Spanish Succession, whereby every ceasefire, every peace, simply leaves people getting ready for the next round because they're unhappy with it. So I think the thing we have to discuss here is not what are we willing to trade to get Russia to stop, but what is our vision of Russia, and what is a Russia we can live with? And what are the ways we can take the issues of conflict and de-escalate them and prevent them from starting future wars?
I mean, this brings me to another thing I was curious about, right? When we talk about the situation with Russia, kind of we seem very often focused on what's happening in, let's say, the western part of Russia, right? We talk about Ukraine, we talk about Crimea, we talk about these areas. But isn't there, and I'm unfortunately neither an expert on the politics of the region nor the states in these regions, but from again, when we talk about existential threats, but isn't an ever-growing, more powerful China in Russia's east, isn't that a more, on the long run, existential threat to Russia than, let's say, the European Union? I mean, we know that there's, for example, substantial migration from China into Siberia. So what happens if one day the Chinese start to hand out, you know, Chinese passports in Siberia, and then you lose, you know, I don't know, Vladivostok, or, you know, whatever it is, or in Central Asia, right? If they would orient themselves more towards China, wouldn't that be not even substantially more diminish Russia's position as a great power than, you know, not being, I'd say, the dominant power in Belarus or Ukraine? Do you think, kind of what I'm trying to get at is if we try to, as much as it is possible to be, we kind of do objective geopolitics, right? What I mean is, so we look at not that these as states with histories, but just as billiard balls, and kind of say, okay, which one could move in which direction? Do you think there might be, is a little bit of mistake on part of Putin to be so focused on Eastern Europe and Western Russia, and thereby maybe completely forgetting that the competition and threat, if you will, might be much greater in the future from the East?
Well, actually, I think Putin is very focused on the East, because the East is actually where opposition is strongest. I mean, there's some liberals in Moscow, but in 2018, they lost the governorship of Khabarovsk to Sergei Fergal, and the Liberal Democratic Party and the Communist Party swept a ton of the elections there, because that's probably the area where, one, the Kremlin regime is least popular, because it's seen as entirely neglecting the area. It's not replaced a lot of its peak cadres in a long time. And they actually arrested the governor of Khabarovsk in 2020 on charges of murder. And you can see the mass protests. They end up expelling a majority of members of the local Duma. So Putin's major focus on the East, I think, is actually domestic subversion, because these are the Liberal Democratic Party, Russian Communist Party, Russia. They're not Navalny's people, which means they're a bit more dangerous, because it's indigenous sort of grassroots opposition. And also the opposition is winning like 60-65% of the vote. It wasn't like winning with like 29% like in some of the Moscow seats. So it was a lot scarier for him. And I think that's actually his bigger priority there than being scared of the Chinese. I mean, the thing with the Chinese is that twofold. One, I mean, China tends to be very aggressive with influence, but the degree to which they move territorially is very, very long-termist. Other than things that they directly claim as part of China, like, for instance, situation across Taiwan Strait. But even there, I think that any resort to force is based on the collapse of the KMT, because I really think that they value above all else peaceful unification as a vindication. They want the KMT to say the CCP was right in the civil war. If they simply inherit a ruin on force, that's much less good than having the losers of the civil war acknowledge they should have won all along. So I think that the Chinese threat is more that Russia becomes a satellite of China geopolitically. And that is, if Russia has no leverage with the West, no options, they're under constant sanctions and other things, then Russia has no option for raw materials. It has no option for selling oil. It has no other option other than to go to China, which means that in terms of the relationship with China, it has no leverage other than basically doing it. And what is China going to do for it? Well, China's not going to support Russia on these anymore than it needs to, but China can distract. If it ever needs anything in the Far East, it can cause trouble for the US or for NATO simply by having the Russians stir up trouble on their borders with Europe. So in effect, Russia is sort of a puppet human shield for China, in which China can cause crises all over the place, whether in the Balkans, in the Middle East, in Central Asia, in Europe, and distract the United States whenever it feels like it. But Russia really doesn't get anything out of that relationship. And that's not a very good alliance. Oddly enough, this is the exact inversion of sort of the reason why Catherine ended up pissing off Prussia and Austria in the 1700s, along with Britain, because she used them as shields to prevent anyone from ever trying to check her ambitions anywhere else. So she expected other people to fight her war. She's like, oh, I'll send some troops and I'll send supplies to help you. But 90% of the fighting is going to be on your territory. So I think the problem for Russia is the alliance with China is a really bad deal, because it's clear what China gets from the alliance. It's not really clear what Russia gets in the long run from it. And I think Putin's aware of it. The problem is you can't have a normal relationship with the West as long as you have sanctions. As long as the Crimea sanctions are in effect, any Russian figure or any company can randomly have sanctions added against them simply for being a participant in the occupation. But worse than that, what he saw with the Trump thing and the whole Russiagate stuff is that the domestic incentives in US politics for reaching an agreement with Russia and being called a sellout are so low, whereas the points you get for accusing your opponent of being a sellout for Russia are so high, that almost no US politician will ever prioritize the strategic need to settle issues with Russia above domestic grandstanding. And anyone who tries to do so, as Donald Trump and some people around him were inclined to do, is going to basically be stopped from doing so. So I think the big importance of impeachment and Trump leaving office was that Putin concluded that the US was never going to drop the sanctions because Russia was not important enough to do it. But as long as those sanctions are in effect, how can you ever have a normal relationship? And no Russian leader can give up the Crimea unilaterally. I mean, it's annexed, it's in there politically. So you're stuck. And that means you're stuck with China. And Xi Jinping knows you're stuck with him, and he's going to treat you in exactly that way. And so, yes, I think this is a problem. And this is one reason why I think you need a vision where the end goal is to not just stop the fighting in Ukraine, but have a situation where you don't have nonstop sanctions on Russia. Now, that will involve Russia accepting Ukrainian independence. It will involve them giving up territory they're holding. But I think it has to also involve us going back and realizing that what Obama did in 2011 to 2013, meddling in Russian internal politics, whether it be the meeting with a hosting opposition like parties at the embassy, or it meant doing sanctions on the LGBT law, you just can't do that. Like, if you're going to do that, then what reason does Russia have to settle real issues if you're constantly going to invent fake issues to have? Now, so I guess I'm coming down the middle. I don't agree with the people who think that you should make significant concessions to Russia to renegotiate from China, not least because I think at this point, they kind of need to show a victory, which means anything you give them is worth less than things they take in the Ukraine. But I think in the long run, if you militarily manage to halt them there and check them there, you need to understand that we need to get away from this sanctioning people every time they do something that we don't like domestically, because that played a huge role in just creating an environment where real issues couldn't be resolved because we had an unlimited number of fake ones.
I mean, because I think this is what I very much also enjoy in your writing, right? I think this is a very sober analysis of the situation on the ground. But I'm wondering, do you think there is a risk that particularly in the near to medium future, that kind of emotions get into the way? And what I mean by this, that the point there to be very clear is not to minimize human suffering or to, what I mean is to belittle human suffering or to not care about human suffering, right? But there needs to be some way out of this. And we saw this, you mentioned also a little bit, kind of the time between World War I and World War II. While I think it is completely understandable from both the moral and the emotional standpoint, right, that you say you want to punish an invader, right? You want to punish a country that commits heinous crimes. I mean, I'm sitting here in Vienna, right? There's then part of Nazi Germany. So we have our own share of committing war crimes and genocide. And I think Japan is a similar thing, right? That you kind of have to almost kind of break this emotionally understandable sentiment and look at it almost in a cynical political way. And will this be particularly on the European end, if you look at kind of the way the political discourse is in Poland and the Baltic, which I sympathize with to some extent, but I'm afraid this could also become an obstacle at some point, because it's no longer a discussion about how can we stabilize Eastern Europe. It's more a discussion about how can we kind of, which I guess we all agree with, right, kind of protect Ukraine, but then also kind of punish and once again contain Russia. And I wonder if this is gonna make a true strategic change or a true strategy impossible in the future.
So I actually think the World War I analogy is good, which is the actual basis of reparations was perfectly solid in the sense that the Germans had occupied Belgium and northeastern France for 4 years. They had absolutely devastated the region and basically lived off of it, and that inflicted billions in damage. So, I mean, the actual argument that this was somehow punitive or looting is nonsense. It was directly calculated in proportion to it and was actually a bit on the low side for it. That said, the question was not whether this is justified. The question is, one, can we collect it? And two, what would be involved in collecting it? And is that not worse? And this is the answer to the question. And that was the correct question. The problem was they answered the question whether this is justified and got into a fight on it. And I actually think they were right. And the Germans in 1919 really were deluding themselves a little bit in terms of what had happened over there. But that said, the problem with it is, if the Germans don't actually believe they're guilty on this, they themselves have been starving because of the blockade, and they thought they won. Are they going to pay this willingly? At which point, any effort to collect is going to destabilize and poison German politics. And that means they're not going to pay. One, it's going to delay their recovery, because efforts to do pay are going to destabilize recovering the European economy, which may cost us more money in the long run, as it did. Secondly, we're going to have to force them to do, which means we're going to have to constantly be moving troops in, which is going to lead to infighting in the alliance. It's going to cost us a lot of money, and it's just going to make large numbers of people upset. And are we going to do that for an extended period? And then if we fail and give up, so we demand they pay, and then we fail to make them pay, that discredits the entire treaty and it vindicates them and undermines us. So if we're not willing to let them pay, to make them pay, we don't have the ability to do so. And if they do, it's actually going to cost everyone more in the long run in terms of reconstruction. We should pass it. Now, I actually said this when I was doing my intro courses on European history at LSE. I said, the single biggest thing that could have prevented World War II, is if the U.S. had, in exchange for giving up reparations, simply forgiven everyone's debts, you would have avoided the deflationary spiral, which really killed everyone in the 20s. Germany had hyperinflation, but that was artificially induced as a deliberate policy. The big thing that killed the French and the British was deflation. And that was because everyone was trying, the U.S. was loaning money to Germany to then pay money to France and Britain under angry and resentful terms that then was used to pay back the US for the money it lent Germany. There was no actual generation of money. Everyone was upset, and money was actually being taken out of the system entirely in the process. It was a dreadful thing. So, but I think that's the thing, is I don't think anyone, I think people are, I don't think people have to ignore the moral thing. You can say that these are war crimes, you say it does. And I think that you, I think that the impunity which is going on here is also a historical thing. I think that you see this going back to issues with sexual assault and other stuff in East Prussia or in the occupation of East Germany, is the response you tend to get in sort of Soviet army or Russian public opinion is, I mean, the attitude has never been particularly good about internal discipline. I don't want to say it's a boys will be boys attitude, but this is a real problem that's been existing for centuries culturally. And there does have to be confrontations, and it does have to be called out. That said, it didn't stop us. It didn't cause us to do World War III with the Russians in 1945, even though it was morally abominable. And it can't be the driving thing on policy now.
Are you afraid that it might be, right? I agree. I think this is a great assessment. But do you think there is a risk that it does become the driving thing?
I think that there's a lot of free riders in foreign policy circles. I think that's enabled by two things. One, people were sort of outside, who are sort of, I also get trying to get clicks or attention on it, but you're trying to sort of define your brand. And obviously in this, being as hardline as possible is a good way to do it. You can go in the opposite direction, be contrarian, but then you have to be very, very contrarian, which is one reason why a bunch of the realists have ended up almost as sort of Russia apologists, because they also have to do the same sort of branding exercise in the opposite direction, because that's why you get picked to go on TV to advocate that view versus other people. I think the bigger issue at a policy level of drift is simply, I don't think there's any real focus in this administration. I think that everyone is very mentally fragmented. I don't think they're, and that means that they're reactive to things they read and see. There's almost an ADHD in which they are feeling the need to do rapid response communications in place of policy. And I thought it was very indicative, actually. I've been offered a position in previous NSC in terms of doing communications. The role I was offered was not actually filled in this administration until mid-September, when Sullivan took a girl over from the DNC to be a spokesman. That means that Jake Sullivan did his own press for the up through August. And this was evident during Afghanistan, because if you watch during the Afghan evacuation, Jake Sullivan was in press conferences. He was on TV. What he was not doing was coordinating between different branches of the government. He was not ensuring that the State Department, the Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security were all coordinating, and they were all working together. And whenever anyone said someone has blocked me, making sure people were on top of it, he was basically running as the spokesman for the National Security Council, as opposed to the National Security Advisor. And he seemed to misunderstand the nature of that job. Now, I think that's basically the problem. I mean, people will say he's incompetent, he's a bad job. And the problem is he doesn't understand what the job is, and he is treating it, now, he's treating it basically as the president's spokesperson for national security, the president's advisor for national security. That may initially have been the idea behind it 50 years ago, but since Kissinger, that's not. It's an operational role that involves running operations, and there is no operations being run, or they're very, very ad hoc. And I think that leads to a situation whereby he feels the need, and people under him feel the need, okay, this outrage has happened. Here are these photos I'm showing you in the press conference. You need a policy response. And he feels, I have to make a policy response. I have to make a statement. You don't. This is why you take a 26-year-old girl from the DNC and have her do it, because she can't set policy. So she can say, we're going to look into it. If this is true, it's an outrage. But Jake will be looking into it. if Jake is there, he has to say what he will do if it's going to be there, which is the additional reason why you don't want to do it, because it means that you are obligated to create, to basically generate a large number of policies with no consideration when you're better off not having them.
I mean, this exactly what you just said, if you allow me just kind of as a kind of a concluding question, because I think this fits nicely, right? I think exactly what you said, I think ADHD is actually a very nice way to describe it. And I think it's not just true in the US administration. I think you see partially in Europe as well. And right, that there you have this a little bit this buildup. Currently, everybody is engaged in being very harsh, let's say, on France and Germany. So one of the fears that I have is whether or not we disagree or disagree with their policies or their approach. And I think there's a lot to be criticized. But this can be, and we talked about this a little bit online at one point, right? I think this could potentially really become a problem for the European Union, because I don't think that the French and the Germans will necessarily forget. I mean, I think we know now that for whatever reason, countries think in historical dimensions, or at least some do. So this idea, as it is also discussed, that you have a new defense alliance between Great Britain, Poland, and Ukraine, and that the future of Europe then is in these. And these are all things I think there is in many ways, there is some credibility to this, but particularly also in the cultural sphere in these areas. But still also economically, right? Germany and France are still the most powerful nations. So this idea that you can now have kind of a shadow European Union that potentially then will also include Ukraine, and France and Germany will just stand by as this is formed primarily as an, again, understandably, but very strongly an emotional reaction to what's happening with Russia. I mean, this does not strike me as a solid basis on the long term, because at some point, again, I know this sounds cynical, but I think we have to be honest about this. This conflict at some point will probably be over. And then kind of the quote unquote undercurrents that never disappeared will reassert themselves. We know this, the last point on this, right? Kind of there is also this outpouring of how this conflict will create, which I'm certain will in some areas, right? The new kind of Ukraine and how many of the problems they had in the past will kind of be almost pushed out by this conflict. But you remember probably as well as I do, we had the Balkan Wars, right? It's not that the conflict between Croats, Serbs, and Slovenes kind of all of a sudden turned these countries into solidly governed, non-wrestling with corruption areas. So these things will come back. It's not that whatever the outcome of this conflict is going to be, there's, I think, this argument that it will turn Ukraine in kind of a second Switzerland or an Eastern Denmark. And as, again, I wish that would be the case, but I think at some point we have to be realistic. Or do you think maybe that these fears are overblown?
Oh, the Balkan analogy is interesting. I go on that because my dissertation was actually on French and Tuchman.
And I speak to the right person.
Yeah. So Tuchman's thesis, which was in his book, which got him significant numbers of comparisons and accusations being a Holocaust apologist, which is not 100% fair. He's basically someone who's John Rosavi, who recognized that what he was doing was bad, which is whereas Milosevic and other people thought they were actually on a good side and heroic. Tuchman is very, and if you read the transcripts of his meetings, he's very aware that what he's doing is bad, but he very much had a view that in the long run, he was going to end these conflicts by making borders line up with populations. Once that happened, everyone would have better states and they could integrate in Europe or whatever sphere they wish to do so. And in some ways, I actually think he was, this is dangerous because
I know.
He's the last person who would deny that he is a war criminal. He might die publicly, but he did not in the transcripts of the presidential meetings or other stuff. But Croatia's part of the EU, and there's an interesting analogy between Russian speakers in Eastern Ukraine now and their kids in age in it. If you're a Serb who's growing up in Zagreb in 1991, the end of Yugoslavia is a huge deal because all of the housing is linked to employment. Jobs are done by the local government. And if they're trying to fire people because of austerity, the question is, do you fire the least qualified or do you fire people who are not Croat because it's Croat and you're being targeted for discrimination, losing jobs, huge deal. You're going from being equal citizens to losing it. But the thing is, if you manage to ride this out and you're an ethnic Croat, you're ethnic Serb in Zagreb in 2022, you have an EU passport. You're in a country where you can work anywhere in the EU. You probably speak English. You're traveling. Why? What on earth do you have in common with the people in Belgrade? Would you ever want to be in Belgrade, much less like Bosnia, where people aren't employed, they're drunk, they keep complaining about things, whereas you have all the latest stuff, you're a European Union citizen. So the idea that even if their parents were felt oppressed and internalized this conflict, their kids are basically Croats. And any sort of effort to liberate them would have been delusional because in some ways they're the beneficiaries of Croatia winning and Serbia losing. And it's not even 100% clear that if Serbia had won, they'd be better off, not worse off, looking at the Republic of Srpska and Bosnia. Now, my supervisor actually was in Eastern Ukraine and lived there for a bit in the late 90s, 98. And he mentioned that all the Russians complained about discrimination because language. If you spoke Russian and not Ukrainian, you could have all the top jobs under Soviet Union. When Soviet Union came in, suddenly, if you don't speak Ukrainian, you can't have any of the top jobs. So if you're someone like that, you either need to learn a new language or you're going from being elite to being second-class citizen. And that's a huge thing for any of the Russians there. And they don't learn it. They simply go under fading pensions. They watch angry Russian media and they resent it. The thing is, their kids who are growing up learned Ukrainian in school, so it's a non-issue. And most of them know English. And the issue is, if you know Russian and English in Ukrainian, are you better off integrating with Russia or the EU? And the answer is, regardless of whether you're a Russian speaker or you're ethnic Russian, you are much better off integrating with the EU if you also speak English than if you don't. So the fact that all of their kids speak English or German means that the Russian speakers, the Russian language, politically and culturally, has largely ceased to exist as a generational thing. And this is something I don't think Putin knows, but if you look at the exit polls for every Ukrainian election since 98, there's a huge age gap. Support for opposition platform was about 27% among over 65s. It was 2% among people under 30. And I think it was 4 or 5% among people under 45, 50. Generationally, I think it's the biggest reason why you haven't seen like volunteers or other stuff for the Russian thing is, and this is a bit hinted in Putin's thing where he's like, you're training people not to be there. So I think there is a generational change in the sense that the divisions that Ukraine had are a product of the economic changes that also affected the different social structure. And they're changing not because, I mean, the war is accelerating it, but it's accelerating something that already happened, which is that people have changed their identities. I guess that's sort of a side thing on Balkans. If you mean in terms of the EU, I mean, in France, I think France and Germany are doing two different things. I think France has been providing enormous amounts of military support, but I think the line Macron is making is that it is not acceptable to be asking for an unlimited commitment and then not say that you can't discuss with the people making that commitment what that commitment is for. And I think that's actually on the right side of his people and a legitimate point. And I think he's also throwing a free-riding argument a little bit at Washington because, you know what, there's 5.5 million Ukrainian refugees. I think the U.S. took 1,800 has fully processed. Europe has all of them. And his point is that they have a bigger burden with it. So I think that's the thing. Now, I think he's done a bad job of marketing this, and I have my own views about Putin. I think that his calls are problematic, but not for the reason everyone says, but I'm not sure if you have time to go into that. If you want to ask, you can. I think Scholz is pandering to the old line in the Social Democrats, and what he's managed to do is destabilize his coalition. And basically, I think he's got resentful that Ukraine is causing him domestic problems, and he's projecting that on Ukraine and getting incredibly passive aggressive. And I think that behavior is not really a policy. It's actually getting the worst of both worlds because he's not actually promoting an end to a war he really wants to end, even on a compromise basis. If anything, he's encouraging Russia to continue it. But he's also basically pissing off everyone sort of else. And I think that's just bad judgment. Whereas I think Macron has legitimate reasons for what he's doing. He's just not executing it well.
You cannot throw out a teaser like that and not follow up. So yes, I need to know what your take on Macron's phone calls.
So, yeah. So, I mean, one thing I had, and this is something that came from one of the things when I was working at private school and doing tutoring, kind of a bunch of people, including Russian oligarchs or people used to work with. And one of the things that was mentioned to me about Vladimir Putin, is that it's not that there's no actual debate or discussion, nor is it that there isn't vigorous disagreement or that he doesn't want opposing views. He does. It's that these are structured in a way that makes them invariably useless. And the thing is that going back, if you read up on it, when he was seizing media outlets in 2001, he'd invite journalists in and say, I'm always willing to meet with enemies, just not traitors. And he just asked them, why won't you work with me? And he just get into arguments with them. And this goes up. The LGBT activist who's getting tons of interviews in the West, we eventually pointed to RT News director. He just called into his office one day and had a two-hour argument in like 2015. I think the problem with it is that, to give a scenario, he does this in a way that reconfirms his existing views. So, for instance, one thing I assume he might have done is when the war broke out, he would not have listened to anti-war arguments. He probably would have called in the kids of like his spokesperson, Pat Scoff and others, and then let them throw the arguments. What this would have done is it would have reaffirmed to him the reason people are anti-war is they're scared of losing their Western friends and their nice Western apartments, which would have legitimized him in ignoring it. Putin very much seems to listen, from what I've been told and impression, to opposing views because he feels a duty to do so before doing what he's going to do anyway, which means he tends to speak with people when he intends to do the opposite and wants to legitimize doing it. So I do think he is having discussions with Macron, but I think Macron may think that he is pushing Putin in his direction. Whereas I think Putin sees listening to Macron for 2 hours, asking him not to do things, as hearing out the arguments for not doing them, and thereby justifying the idea that he has run a full consultative process, he's heard the best arguments, he's considered all sides, and therefore he's justified in doing them. And I mean, there are people who said that, who used to do this, who've given up on doing it or opt out or said that people in Russia have sort of done it because he only calls you in when he wants to do the opposite. And if Macron hasn't figured that out, I think he's actually accomplishing the opposite of what he thinks he's doing, which is he's legitimizing Putin, ignoring whatever he's asking to do, because Putin's assumption is, okay, if Macron's doing this, why does Macron want to do it? What I'm really hearing is his agenda, and this, therefore, is the agenda behind any argument Macron makes, which means if anyone else makes these arguments, they're making them for the reasons Macron is. I mean, that's a little bit of psychoanalysis based just on impressions and from having spoken with people and read up on it. But I mean, that's why I think those are perhaps not as helpful. Not that he's speaking with him or legitimizing it. I mean, he is, but not in the PR way.
No, and I mean, you made, I think also the point you made previously, I think is an important one, right? I think that if you ask for unconditional support, I think it is understandable that those who provide that support want to have, or they at least want to be consulted when it comes to the potential war aims. I think this is, again, one of these, I think it's in the heat of the emotions, right? There's constantly this argument, the only party that can decide when the war ends is, when and where the war ends is Ukraine. And again, I understand this very much from an emotional perspective, but politically, as you say, right, this whoever is providing the weaponry, of course they want to have, I assume, some, or they should at least, again, be consulted on these matters. Because as a kind of as a concluding question, because we talk, and it fits nicely with the psychoanalysis, I think, let's assume for a second, we talked about this at the beginning, kind of going back to the beginning of our conversation, that Russia is announcing a unilateral ceasefire, right? They say, okay, whatever we have occupied, we stays occupied, but from our end, right, we're willing to cease hostilities, in 24 hours. And then we assume, which again, I think would be potentially understandable, right, that Ukraine says, that they see it as a sign, now would be the right moment to go on the offensive. I wonder how this would be perceived in Europe, because you made, I think, one very important point about the German Chancellor Scholz, right? He wants this conflict just to be over. So if there is, if that conflict would be over and it would mean that Ukraine would lose 20% of its territory, I think that's about what the current occupation forces of Russia are, he would be willing to take this. And if now Ukraine would still try and kind of to push back to previous borders, do you think there is then a risk that at least in some circles in the West, right, this all of a sudden that the mood would swing and that all of a sudden Ukraine would be perceived as an aggressor compared to the Russians? As absurd as this might sound, but right from a purely psychological perspective, or what do you think?
So I think that if Schultz were calm and considered on this, he'd realize that, one, Ukraine has to insist that it won't accept it and they'll consider offensive operations. But secondly, the Ukraine really can't do much in terms of offensive operations, in that it's fairly clear from the Kherson and Kharkov things that major offensives in the open against fortified areas are probably beyond their capabilities and probably unwise in terms of exposing their best units to sort of destruction or bombardment. So while I'm certain the Ukrainians, for PR purposes, would insist that they were launching offensives and do limited ones in terms of shelling, and I'm pretty sure the Russians, despite the ceasefire, would claim violations as a basis to continue shelling themselves, even if the Ukrainians did nothing. I actually don't think that the danger of that war continuing is in practice is that big, in the sense that I think if the Russians stopped where they are right now, 90% of this would die down simply for lack of ability to continue it on both sides, not necessarily because people would have to make the decision. So in that sense, I think it would be wise for Schultz to realize that forcing the Ukrainians to publicly admit that they're going to accept it is probably not worth it if de facto he's going to get what he wants anyway over an extended period of time. Now, if he decides he has to force the issue, which, to be fair, I think, again, is in character given somewhat erratic behavior. And again, I don't want to go too much into like geopolitics on it. That would probably be unwise and that could force a bit of a crisis. But again, I think that that's less of a risk because I think that the any major Ukrainian offense is going to take probably 6 to 9 months of massive supply of heavy weapons and training and the creation of new units, because I think their units are exhausted. The units in the front line would need to be trained to use the offensive weapons. I actually think the Ukrainians need air superiority to seriously take back things like Kherson and Mykolaiv and stuff, because otherwise moving in the open there is just too dangerous. They need some way to take out those defenses, which means they need their drones to operate, which means they need the ability for the air superiority to protect the drones. And that's a bit of a longer term project. I mean, what I would do in that instance is I would very much insist on holding the Russians to it while massively resupplying the Ukrainians with that stuff and start working and then test the Russians to do it and then force them to be the aggressors.
So as a final question, so what's your outlook over the next 2 to 3 months? If you would speculate, right? A pure speculation, kind of, you know, if this would be a private, you know, if this is a private conversation, what would your speculation be?
So I think that Putin is getting increased confidence both from the greater political problems coming from inflation in the West and the perspective that that's wearing it down. And I think he's getting enough information from reliable sources, not just unreliable, to indicate that the Ukrainians are being worn down and doing it. And that if he continues this, they're going to be committed to fighting a PR war in sort of the Donbass and Luhansk. I think that there's going to be a pause. I think they're probably most likely militarily, it could be wrong, I think they're going to take over the rest of Luhansk Oblast. And then I think the question is, there'll be a bit of a pause for a bit. And then the Russians are probably going to start a 2 or 3 month thing to try and take the rest of Donetsk in the same way. I think at the end of that, they'll probably stop at some point on there and do a pause depending on where things are. I think that that gives them the victory, which is the Ukrainian defeat. And I think at that point, they will sort of vaguely see where things are headed. And I think part of that will then be to wait and hope that Western disinterest and lack of support demoralizes the Ukrainians and weakens their resolve over time.
Okay, but I say we have to get together.
Oh, I think they might actually, I mean, they might also move to unilaterally annex or declare independence in some of the years, because that's an easy political win. It's also a direct challenge to the West. And the thing is, if you do a ceasefire and then declare the independence on it, that allows you to do an offensive politically without having to sustain a military one. So it's a bit of a free thing there.
So I guess that we have to get together again in 2 or 3 months and discuss the next developments, because this is probably going to stay with us for quite a while.
All right. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you so much, Ellen.